listening to Thinking About Drinking with David Breudberg. This time, the magic potion.
I'm weak for daiquiris.
I drink as kind of an end of the week celebration.
Oh, I would have it behind a tree by myself just to have it. Wouldn't be no special occasion about it.
Yeah, I usually unwind with a beer at the end of the day.
I'll usually drink basically because the people I'm with are drinking, so I'll have a drink too. I don't drink very often, so I don't like to drink.
It tastes great. I like having wine with dinner, but also certainly a big favorite is vodka.
Right now I'm sort of in a health phase, and I haven't sworn off alcohol. It's one of my last things, and I probably won't, but I don't overindulge in drugs.
Alcohol, the mysterious elixir. In nature, it's the innocent byproduct of fermented fruits and grains. But in human society, alcohol wields the power of transcendence, a momentary release from the dullness, the discomfort of our private worlds. For some, there is a god of wine. For others, intoxicants are the devil's brew. Use of alcohol is so commonplace that the word drinking itself has come to mean imbibing booze. We drink to heighten the excitement of sporting events. Wine is an ingredient in religious observance. We celebrate weddings with champagne. We drink to lubricate social interchange in college bars. Fully a third of Americans abstain totally from liquor, but the rest of us can be found in the spectrum of drinkers, from those who mildly sip as a social amenity to hardcore drunkards. How you use alcohol says something about who you are.
Because it's a mind changer, perhaps, it seems to attract symbolism to it.
Social scientist Robin Room in Berkeley, California, has studied drinking patterns for over 20 years.
It's a very clear way of signaling things that people want to signal to each other in one way or another. If I'm your boss and I say, let's go out and have a drink, then that's a clear signal that we're putting our work roles aside and that we're going to be treating each other as equals. To offer to buy someone a drink or to accept that someone will buy you a drink is the beginning of a relationship. Where the father pours a drink for the son, it's a kind of signal of accepting him as an adult.
Although alcohol remains a common prop in the social scene, there are signs that the allure of drinking has lost some of its magic. Overall, consumption in the United States, which had climbed steadily since the 1950s, peaked around 1981. It has dropped slightly since. Americans who drink are turning more and more to relatively low alcohol beverages like light beers and wine coolers. Ben Mason of the Coors Brewery in Golden, Colorado.
Drinking patterns tend to reflect the lifestyle of the people. And lifestyle in this country has become one of more diet conscious people, more exercise wellness oriented people. There is obviously a trend in this country toward lighter beverages. And beer, just by nature of the brewing process and how it's packaged and presented in this country, is a beverage of moderation.
Manufacturers of the three types of alcoholic beverages, beer, wine, and so-called hard liquor or distilled spirits, frequently portray their products in glowing health terms. But nothing could be further from the truth, according to alcohol researcher and author Lucy Barry Robe.
If alcohol were discovered today in some lab in this town, there is no way that the Food and Drug Administration would clear it for sale as a prescription drug even, because look at the birth defects that it causes, look at the addictive properties that it has, and look at the drugs that are wiped off the market that are shown to cause birth defects in animals. Now, alcohol causes the same birth defects in animals that it does in humans.
In a recent study of grammar school kids, between 4th and 6th grade, most of them didn't know alcohol was a drug. They knew marijuana was a drug.
Jim Mosier specializes in alcohol policy at the Trauma Foundation in San Francisco.
They didn't know it was a drug. People in this society don't think of it as a drug because it's so pervasive. It's an ordinary product in our society.
Is wine a drug?
Is wine a drug? No, wine is not a drug. Wine is an agricultural beverage classified by the state of California as a food made up of over 300 components or constituents in addition to ethyl alcohol.
Patricia Schneider of the Wine Institute, a California-based trade association.
The proper role of wine in society, table wine in particular, is as a table beverage, as an accompaniment to food, and as a beverage that, again, is associated with moderate health practices and enhanced health and longevity.
The alcohol in wine is the same substance found in all varieties of booze, with the same potential for drunkenness and addiction. And yet, perhaps above other intoxicating beverages, wine carries a mystique dating to ancient times. Today, an entire subculture of wine connoisseurs revels in the fermented grape. The variety of alcohol products available is astonishing. Wine lover and author Harvey Finkel joined me on a tour of the spacious Brookline Liquor Mart in Boston.
Well, we're looking at bottles, chiefly. Many bottles. Most of them are wine. Although over on the right there are spirits, and then further over there's a large case with a large variety of beers.
And what's your favorite part of the store? Could you take me to where you would normally begin your inspection?
I would kind of wander in through the wine part, and the wines are arranged in relatively logical sections, usually by geography.
We strolled past displays of California wines, Burgundy wines, sparkling wines, including champagne. But, says Harvey Finkel, for those who indulge, there's a time and place for everything.
Like most of our customs, it's based upon usage, and it works. I mean, the things we do. So most people, with a steak or a roast beef, will have a dry, fairly hearty red wine. And the reason really becomes it tastes better that way, it works better, and sometimes another wine just won't marry with the flavors, textures, whatever, of the steak in this case.
Although he lingered lovingly in the wine section, I was able to pry my tour guide away. We continued our excursion at the distilled spirits aisle.
On the left here we have what the trade calls the whites versus the browns, the whites being things like vodka and gin, which of course very large sellers, and maybe rum would probably be very popular among spirits.
And these are transparent beverages.
Like
they look like water,
mm-hmm.
But they're a bit more potent, I take it.
I think so. So I've heard. As we go down, we'll see some more variety. Here we are in the rum section. Rum is a very good blender. Rum comes from many of the Caribbean islands, from some Central American places. And here we have a whole bunch of Canadian whiskeys, and then American whiskeys, and then bourbon.
Could you briefly compare the flavors of these different spirits groups?
Vodka has virtually no flavor. It has it's alcohol. Basically, it's sort of diluted alcohol. And gin is a flavored. It's similar in character, except it's flavored, and it's flavored with a number of things, but the juniper berries being perhaps the most important one. Whiskies have more flavor of the originating material because they're not distilled off at such a high proof. Whiskies come from a grain, which are the starch in the grain is converted to sugar in the process, which is in turn fermented, and one gets, in essence, a beer. Now, if the process stopped there, one would have a beer. And if one distills the fermented grain or beer, one gets a spirit or whiskey.
Okay.
The other kind of product, besides the ones we're talking about, are flavored and sweetened, these would be the cordials and liqueurs, in which you can have any flavor, and you know the flavors are infinite. Many fruits, herbs, berries, nuts, chocolate, cream de coco, for example.
Okay. In our little tour of this liquor store, we've now come before the refrigerated case where the beer is mm-hmm. stored. Yeah. There's quite a variety of beers here. Yeah, there. I don't know how many beers are made in the world, but there must be thousands, and it's really actually very interesting to taste through. You can't get through all of them, but it's fun to taste it. The styles are very different. To me, the mass-produced American beers are not satisfactory. And there are beers made here and elsewhere, not only overseas, but in the United States, which are made very much more carefully and not mass-produced and much more flavorful.
The multiplicity of alcoholic beverages fuels a $70 billion marketplace for booze. Beer dominates the industry with fairly steady sales. Next most popular are spirits, a product on the decline. And the wine industry, least in volume, has shown most growth of late with the success of its fruit-flavored wine coolers.
These are huge, huge multinationals we're talking about with tremendous resources and tremendous stake in their industry.
Prevention researcher Jim Mosier.
Anheuser-Busch and Miller control almost 60% of the beer market. The still spirits is almost as concentrated with about three or four companies.
Seagram's
is a big one. Hubline is a big one. And then the wine industry is the most diversified, but we have Gallo controlling about 30%, a little under 30%, and another five or six controlling up to 50% of the market. It's a lot more concentrated than that sounds like, because these companies, Seagram's, for instance, has got a huge stake in the wine industry. And if you add the cigarette companies, you've got Reynolds that owns Hubline, and you've got Philip Morris that owns Miller Beer. We did a little study. We looked at eight companies and found that those eight companies controlled half or more of the beer, wine, distilled spirits, cigarettes, and soft drink markets. These are huge companies with huge marketing budgets and huge lobbying budgets.
We are now in the brew house, and this is the heart of the brewery. In the brew house, we are going to change our starches into sugars. In other words, we're making food for Mr. Yeast.
We are visiting the world's largest brewery at the Adolph Coors Company in Golden, Colorado. The gigantic plant last year produced the equivalent of over 209 million cases of beer. The process begins with malted grain from the barley plant.
We're going to take the barley malt, weigh it, grind it into flour form, drop it into the batch bins, from there directly into the copper kettles. Let's go down this way and we can look at all the copper kettles out here. These are our cooking vessels. The ingredients will start at 44 degrees centigrade. Then the temperatures will vary as it comes down to the floor level to the other kettles it loads out from underneath. And temperatures can go as high as 112 degrees centigrade. So, in between 65 degrees centigrade and 75 degrees centigrade, in that middle range, we have the final conversion or change of starch to sugar. We then separate out those sugars. We're going to use the liquid, bring it down to the brew kettle, add the hops, boil at a rolling boil, and that would be over 200 degrees. Anywhere from 2 to 4 hours, depending on which product we're making. And as we cool it down, send it into fermenting and add the yeast, it's under sterile conditions. 7 days later, we have beer at 45 degrees temperature. At this point, it doesn't have a good taste to it. It's a green beer or a raw beer. So from here, we want to improve that flavor, so we lager it, or it comes from the German word lagern, to age in a cool place.
Manufacturing is only part of the odyssey for alcoholic beverages. The next phase of processing begins as human beings ingest booze. When you drink, alcohol travels from the mouth to the stomach through the small intestines, and from there is released into the bloodstream. Physician Max Schneider in Los Angeles.
The alcohol, as it circulates, is absorbed by all tissues in the body. The more moist, the more water content in those tissues, the greater is the amount of alcohol absorbed, so that the brain, the liver, and the heart and the muscles will absorb more alcohol than will, for instance, the bone, which is relatively dry.
The chemical works its toxic or poisonous effect on the various parts of the body. But the most noticeable change occurs when alcohol reaches the central nervous system and the brain. Initially, the drinker is euphoric for about half an hour. Inhibition seems to fly away. But then you become groggy and lose your sense of balance. At higher doses, you begin to slur speech, become depressive, and perhaps aggressive. In a word, you are drunk.
I think I had one or maybe two bourbons with ginger ale, and I remember it went straight to my knees. I could hardly walk. And I've never forgotten that. So I've never been a heavy drinker. I can't drink very much.
It's one of those nights when I guess I just couldn't say no to the Black Russians that kept getting bought for me. And I remember being at least having the good sense of not driving home, getting dropped off, and throwing up on my parents' front lawn, and actually being sick in bed, presumably with alcohol poisoning, for probably the next 3 days.
I knew I was sick. My whole head felt dizzy, and I was just, like, stumbling along. My boyfriend was trying to hold me up, and I started throwing up there, and it was just, like, all over the car, and then I was going, stop the car, let me out.
We got a boy and a girl to sit down in a session. We gave them a placebo drink at one time, and we gave them alcohol.
Ernest Noble is former director of the government's National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism.
We didn't give them very high doses, and we just asked them to talk to each other and communicate, and we videoed their interaction. And it was amazing how there was very poor communication. In other words, when the fellow was talking, you know, the girl would interrupt and vice versa, and there was no continuity of speech, really, basically. It was really crazy kind of talking. But when we asked these people after the session how they felt after the alcohol, they said, oh, they thought they were very witty, very intelligent, and were making some very deep, you know, philosophical statements.
Considering the social confusion, the mental disturbance, and the physical ordeal of alcohol, why do people drink? To some, it's an anesthesia for emotional pain, even if that pain returns when the initial buzz wears off. Perhaps the breakneck pace of change in modern society renders some of us simply unable to cope, and maybe we've lost touch with the inner peace lying dormant in all human beings. People drink to escape, and they need to escape because, to some extent, they are suffering.
It's 9 o'clock on a Saturday. A regular crowd shuffles in. There's an old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin.
Personal pain is part of why people use alcohol, but they're drawn to do so in a social environment that often seems to promote drinking, and that sends a message to kids.
There are all kinds of signals that alcohol is a good thing. At least if you're from a 9-year-old's point of view, it's certainly an attractive thing.
Ruth Salavoris of the NWAer Advertising Agency in New York. She's concerned that our media, including TV commercials, are pushing alcohol on young people.
It's depicted and it's seen in ways that are associated with friends, sociability, fun, good times, celebrations, weddings, bar mitzvahs, that kind of thing. So that it has a connotation that kids get very quickly. I mean, they see it as a pleasurable thing.
It's fun getting to the bottom of one.
White Mountain Cooler.
Cooler.
Keeping it light.
Cooler.
Crisp and refreshing.
It's got the taste that's always right.
It's fun.
We live in a society now where alcohol is promoted as the great panacea.
Physician Nicholas Pace in New York.
You know, take a look at what the average magazine shows you in terms of ads. You know, if the train is late, you should launch another drink, and if the plane is late, you should break out the booze, and of course, she ought to be waiting at home with a couple of drinks in her hand when you arrive after a hard day's worth of work. If you want to make love, you should maybe have a drink before. And if you want to discuss any business, you should have a drink. And I'll meet you for a drink. And so I deal every day with trying to get people to understand the tremendous social pressures out there for people to drink and to drink a lot.
How we respond to those pressures depends. Some ethnic groups seem especially prone to heavy drinking, including Native Americans and those born of Irish and Scandinavian descent. The reasons may include cultural traditions and perhaps even the genetic makeup of those groups. In some parts of society, notably the Bible Belt, alcohol appears to be less common.
About half of the country disapproves of drinking.
Public opinion analyst George Gallup.
I mean, there is a negative feeling about drinking in general, but far fewer, but still a surprisingly high proportion, do favor a return to prohibition. There are moral reasons for doing so. There are some feel that it's unhealthy. Some feel that it is dangerous to others.
I think the government should be make sure that people don't drive and drink, or you know, things like that, by some regulation. And I think they should, you know, make sure that children, or however you want to define them, can't just walk into a store and buy a bottle of booze or wine or anything, and you know, get in trouble because they're probably not responsible. But after that, I don't think the government has any business telling, you know, you or me what hour we could buy liquor in, or wine or beer, and the weather we can, and so on.
Wine connoisseur Harvey Finkel.
I think there are too many people who look upon other people and want them to do according to the people looking. In other words, they're very self-centered, and they think they're arrogant. I think it's arrogance. They're arrogant enough to believe they know what is right in every sense. And I think that there's also the kind of Puritan ethic which somehow spills over and says that anything that's fun or enjoyable must be wicked and therefore ought to be prohibited. As long as you're not doing anyone else any harm, it seems to me that there's nothing wrong with it.
Throughout American history, the right to drink has often been at odds with the right of society to be protected from alcohol abuse. Ever since prohibition of alcohol sales was repealed in 1933, our policies toward drinking have largely been laissez-faire. But in the early 1980s, a new sense of urgency entered the national consciousness.
Okay. You're going to be placed under arrest for operating under the influence and for operating without a license. Okay? Why don't you step over here?
Okay.
Each year, drinking and driving kills more than 20,000 Americans and causes over 500,000 injuries. The tragedy claimed the life of a college senior named Sarah Nealand in Athens, Ohio. Her mother, Sally Nealand, is now a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
The accident report says that she was two blocks from her apartment, driving at 10 miles an hour with her seatbelt fastened. At that time, there was a young man who the police had been following down the main street of the small college town, noticing that he was weaving and driving erratically. When he turned the corner onto the street that she was driving on, they turned on their blue lights. And at that point, apparently, he turned, looked in his rearview mirror, and stepped on the gas and went up the hill, went through two red lights, and did not make the curve that she was coming around and crashed into her head-on. The police report says that she was killed instantly.
Driving under the influence has emerged as perhaps our most graphic symbol of alcohol abuse. But virtually wherever there is social disruption, drinking can't be far behind. Alcohol is implicated in at least half of all cases of murder, rape, suicide, child abuse, and aggravated assault. When we recently visited a Chicago police station, Officer Ronald Starks had just returned from handling a drinking-related disturbance.
The boyfriend was drunk, and he had hit his girlfriend. And she called the police because she wanted him out of the apartment. So when I got there, like I said, he was incoherent, and he didn't want to talk to me, and he didn't want me to talk to him. So I told him that he was under arrest, and I had to talk my way to the point, calming him down till I got some help because I was by myself. So when the other two officers came with the wagon, you know, we put him under arrest, handcuffed him. At this time, as we were taking him out of the apartment, he was cursing at us and threatening his girlfriend that he was going to come back and beat her up. But situations like this, you know, this is not the first time.
Society must intervene when alcohol abusers injure others. But just as tragic is the harm that excessive drinkers inflict on themselves. The heaviest users, comprising only 10% of the drinking population, consume more than half of all the booze sold. High doses of alcohol often damage the liver, the brain, and a host of other organs. These problem drinkers are in serious trouble with booze. Providence, Rhode Island physician David Lewis.
Potentially, it's a cause of a lot of difficulty that's seen in medical practice day to day. And in general hospital settings, when you survey this, 20, 30, sometimes 40% of patients that are hospitalized in general hospitals have really serious drinking problems.
My father died of alcoholism.
Cirrhosis?
Massive CVA.
CVA is?
Cerebral vascular accident. Stroke brought about by alcoholism. Of course, that didn't appear on the death certificate, but we knew what it was.
Alcohol can murder, but it rarely kills all of the sudden. The magic potion prefers to seduce its victims gradually. Many drinkers don't realize when they begin drifting into alcohol problems. But prevention experts are encouraged by the health-conscious trend of lower consumption. It means Americans are more attentive to the dangers of problem drinking. They hope it signals a broad shift in social attitudes. Prevention advocate Albert Kramer of Quincy, Massachusetts.
Right now with alcohol, if you try to be at the bar and say, I don't drink, you apologize. In fact, you might have a soda water that you have to hold in your hand because everybody else is drinking. And drinkers have a tendency to want to push others to drink with them. And I think we'll always be a drinking society. You know, we have been since we first learned to ferment grapes. We're going to be. And I'm not preaching any kind of going back to prohibition. It's just that I think we can begin to understand that we don't need 9 drinks and get fall over each other and become both sick and offensive in order to enjoy ourselves. That really, that is excessive. And when we do that, I think people conduct parties are going to try to do that. But secondly, they're also learning they don't have to be apologizing for not drinking. I think they're going to be able to say, I'll have a soda water and be proud of it. And somebody else drinking who's going to get their fourth drink is very worried about saying, I'll have my fourth scotch.
I think a lot of the attitudes are changing. I know for myself that I'd much more admire someone who's outgoing in the life of the party who didn't drink than someone who's outgoing in life of the party who did drink. I mean, that to me would just, that's so great to see someone who doesn't need that to boost them, that can do it all on their own.
Thinking About Drinking is a co-production of Sound Documentaries and Western Public Radio in association with WGBH Boston. If you'd like free information about solving alcohol problems or about cassette tapes of this series, please write us at Thinking About Drinking, P.O. Box 777, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02139. That's Thinking About Drinking, P.O. Box 777, Cambridge, Mass., 02139. This program was written and produced by David Freudberg, studio producer Dean Capello, associate producer Andrew Neville. Our address again is Thinking About Drinking, P.O. Box 777, Cambridge, Mass., 02139.
Distribution of this program was made possible with funds provided by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.